Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge, and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, it's just whenever I finish a book, I do the review and stick it up here on the podcast feed for everyone to download and listen to and hopefully enjoy. So today is an extra special episode because what I'm going to do is going to be reviewing and talking and discussing about a book that I've read before in the last few years, and so have previously reviewed. The book is Hyperion by Dan Simmons, but instead of me doing this by myself, my girlfriend, Juliana, here has just recently read the book, or you listened to it as an audiobook, and so say hi, Juliana.
Hi.
And she's here, so we're gonna just talk through some of this. So this is going to be, we're going to just talk about some other bits and pieces at the beginning, but when we get into it, this is going to be a spoiler. This is going to be a spoiler review, so we're going to talk just about the book. I've already done a review of this where I don't do any spoilers and I give a general impression, show how much I, you know, talk about how much I enjoyed it. So if you want a non-spoiler review, you can go back and listen to episode number, I think, 49. Let me just flick across to my notes here. Yeah, episode 49, I discuss it. Whereas here, we're just going to get on, and we're going to just discuss, we're not going to, like, spoil things on purpose, but we're not going to let not spoiling the story get in the way. So before we start off some news, I finished a novel and put it up online. It's called Broken Glass. It's the third novel in the Minding Tomorrow trilogy, which I started writing back, well, originally I started writing it back in 2003, but I probably started writing it in 2008 after I started this podcast, which means that this podcast has been almost 5 years now. And so I wrote the first novel, Mining Tomorrow, and then the second, Combat, and now this final one, Broken Glass, finishes off the story, the main story, and kind of fills in what all the characters have been up to and what they get up to in the future. But of course, it's a little bit of a time travel story, so this it's not all in the future. And you've read it, haven't you, Juliana?
Yes, I enjoyed it.
Yeah, your unbiased opinion of Broken Glass is what?
Like, I read it after reading Mining Tomorrow and Combat, and it works really well in the series. Yeah. And, well, yeah, it's just an enjoyable book, and
yeah,
you can read through it and just have a story.
A complete story.
A complete story in your head.
Yeah, what I like about Combat, as opposed to the other, well, not as opposed to the other ones, is like Mining Tomorrow, I had sort of like something very specific in mind, and because it was like the first novel that I finished writing. The reason why I managed to finish it was because I narrowed down the scope quite a lot, because the original story would have taken up all of the main story from, like, Mining Tomorrow, not so much Combat, a bit of Combat, but Mining Tomorrow all the way through to the end of Broken Glass, and I thought, I can't do that, so I really stripped the story down, unlike George Lucas in his Star Wars, he said, oh yes, I had it all worked out in advance. I actually did have, you know, the vast majority of it already worked out in advance, and a lot of the technology that was introduced in Combat, or the science fiction elements in Combat, was meant to be introduced in Minding Tomorrow as well, because those are the kind of all those technologies sort of have to play into each other to explore the overall storyline and themes that I do throughout the trilogy of novels. But I kind of stripped it down, and Combat kind of told a different story, and it's a different style. But then when it got to when it got to Broken Glass, I was just like, right, what's all the cool stuff that I wanted to put into this story? And so all of the cool scenes that I had in mind in the other novels and cut out, all the stuff that I wanted to include in the other ones, I was just like, right, that goes in there, and that goes in there. Oh, and we can have two trips into space rather than just one each. In I think there's one in Mining Tomorrow and one in Combat, which is only just referenced in Combat, was here. I was like, oh, right, they can go into space here, and they can do all this kind of stuff, you know, and all these different characters can come in and play into each other. And so it was a lot of fun to write. And then when I actually got around to finishing the editing of it, again, when I was reading, I was, oh, that's really good to see. Oh, that's really good. And I think it's definitely much more of a kind of in the vein of Mining Tomorrow than it is Combat, because Combat is a weird book that I wrote as more of a personal project in a way. And I think it follows on much more like Minding Tomorrow. So if you really enjoyed Minding Tomorrow and thought Combat was like, oh, okay, I think Broken Glass is the best of the three, but it kind of relies on the previous two to get through. What do you think?
Yes, definitely. This is exactly what happened to me. I enjoyed Mining Tomorrow, and then I read Combat, and it was like, oh, well, it's sort of weapons and then fighting and all that.
It's called Combat.
Yes, of course, but like that was, yeah, not so much adventure and cool technology and all that.
Well, it's strange because Combat is sort of my comment on military science fiction. And I really enjoy military science fiction, but so much of it seems to be just like, woohoo, guns, woohoo, like that. And like that story tells, like at the beginning, it's like, woohoo, guns. And by the end of it, it's like, guns. And as it goes through the different stories, you're like, oh yeah, people get hurt and stuff like that. And it's like a personal story, kind of telling the story, retelling the story of my father's own experience in the military. So it is slightly more personal, whereas when we get back into combat, it's much more like, woohoo, guns. No, not guns so much. It's more like, woohoo, technology, and sort of like using technology for good rather than in combat, where it's sort of like technology being used for bad. So yes, combat is a little bit more of a downer after Mine Need Tomorrow, but then I think it picks up quite a lot in... I mean, they're just three totally different novels, but I think it works quite well as a trilogy. Well, hopefully it does. Anyway, so I think that's enough about that. You can get that for free on my website as an ebook. You can just go along to lukeburge.com and click on the original fiction link, and there's links to all the ebooks there. They've even got like mobby format to use on your Kindle and things like that. And maybe one day I'll even do an audiobook, but the audiobook recording that I've been trying not working out too well. We'll get back to that sometime. So anyway, what's next on the notes? Because we've been talking too much about that. Oh yeah, Audible they've got this new feature out on Audible, which means that you can sync between the audiobooks and ebooks, because Audible is owned by Amazon, and the Kindle store is of course owned by Amazon. And they've got this feature now where you can listen to an audiobook, pause, And then you go to your Kindle book, and it's at that point in the Kindle book, and then you can read a bit and pause, and you go back to the Audible app and start launching it. Of course, you need the Kindle ebook reader app on your phone and the Audible audiobook app on your phone, which that's what you use, isn't it?
That's actually a really great invention. I use the Audible app for listening to audiobooks, especially when I'm working, because I sit in an office and sit in front of a computer and I can't read in that time. Of course not. But what I can do is like work with stupid, boring spreadsheets and listen to audiobooks at the same time. And then in the evening, when you come home, you can keep on reading at the
however,
same point.
However, the problem is that you've got to buy the audiobook version and you've got to buy the ebook version at the same time. Now, I wish they just had like a combined price or like a combined
very
thing.
Very true, yes.
Yeah, so they're actually, it's a good idea if you've already bought both books, but I'm not sure how many people are going to buy both. I mentioned this because this was, I think, in episode, was it 150 of the podcast, which was a, I think I talked about, yes, episode 150, I talked about reading novels, and this was one of the things that I hoped would come along in the future, and now it has done. But let's talk about a bit more about the Audible app. That's what you use to listen to audiobooks, and the reason is we worked out that even on Juliana's iPhone, if she entered in my credentials from Audible, I mean, she could just listen to all of the audiobooks that I've listened to already, so that's been handy for her listening to some audiobooks that I've listened to in the past myself.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. But I must admit, I only did that, rediscovered that, and I did one audiobook of yours, which is The Scar.
Yeah.
And I downloaded another one, which is Dune, and started listening to that.
Oh, yeah.
Totally confused ending listening to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I said The Scar is a good one to start off with. Because Juliana, you normally listen in German, like with Hyperion that we're going to discuss today. You listen to it as a German ebook.
Yes.
Audiobook. And what was the other one that you listened to in
Ubik.
German? Ubik, yeah, by Philip K. Dick. So, yeah, and I was like, don't bother with the English version of Dune, the audiobook, and don't even bother with the German audiobook version of Dune. Go straight to a real book, like the ebook or a paperbook, because I think that's a book which, I mean, I enjoyed it a lot in audio, but only because I've read it, you know, five times before as a real book. Otherwise, I think it's way too confusing.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I only found the English ebook version. The German ebooks are still quite a while behind. It's difficult to find.
Well, it wasn't in iBooks, that was it, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was not in iBooks, but I searched for it online and I didn't find anything. So
yeah.
I probably need to find a paper book in the German.
It'll be there. Version. You'll be able to find that, no problem. So what are the other ebooks that you've read? We're just sort of discussing about what do you have here in your iBooks library, because that's where you got some of this. Because Juliana was like, hey, I want to get back into science fiction, because you read it when you were younger. Yeah,
yes, I did quite a lot of science fiction when I was younger, but then I read more detective stories and criminal stories, and that was my passion for a while. And yeah, my first science fiction novel which I read now,
yeah,
like
recently,
a
yeah.
year ago or something, was Ray Bradbury.
Yeah.
Fahrenheit 451.
Yep.
And then I kept on with Isaac Asimov. Which
yeah, because
you
like the detective, you like the crime story. So I was like, well, try out The Caves of Steel and that series of detective novels.
And that was really good. I enjoyed that very much.
Yeah.
And then I kept on with the Robots of Dawn, which were quite different, but still still like the themes and characters came back from Caves of Steel. And then
you got into some of my favourites. You got Alistair Reynolds. You did two of his books, did you? Or one of his books?
I think one.
Yeah, Revelation Space.
Yes.
And also Ian M. Banks. You did the Player of Games. And no, what was the first one? Yeah, the Player of Games.
I read the Algebrist. Algebrist first in
German.
In German.
Yeah.
And then I read the Player of Games and Use of Weapons also in German.
Yep, which is pretty good.
And, oh yeah, in between I read The War of the Worlds in English.
Okay. And that worked out okay?
That was good.
And you got some more here. What was that? You got the Time Machine, which would be pretty good. And I can't see other science fiction books. Oh yeah, we're going to talk about Perry Rodan. This is the worst thing about German ebooks and audiobooks and stuff. Yeah,
that's terrible. Like, I don't understand why the German science fiction sections in ebooks and in Audible, you always find these series of Perry Rodan books, which are like little, like you can have them as paper books as well, and they are like this small, tiny, like thin books.
It's like an adventure serial.
It's like, I think they started that in the 70s or something, and like
there still going.
It's still going, and then you had these few authors they wrote about this character.
Do they all take the same name, or is it just?
Yeah, it's always Perry Rodan.
No, the name of the character, because there's some series where they have a character, but they also have the author, and the author is always the same. I think like the Nancy Drew stories are famous for that. They all different authors write the different books, but they all write under the same name.
No, they write under their names all.
But they write the same characters.
They write the same characters, and I downloaded one.
Yeah.
And I tried to read it. Like, I wanted to know what it is about. I downloaded, I think, the first of it.
Yeah.
And I couldn't read it. It was so badly written. It was like weird sentences, just like one sentence was just a main, like, how you do that, the object, like object, and
they're all mixed up. Yeah,
it's just like so easy written that it's not, it doesn't make any story in my mind.
Yeah,
and it was so bad, I had to stop it.
But what happens is when you search science fiction or you click on science fiction in iBooks or in Audible, there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of these books, so they just come on. It's like latest releases, and you've got to, like, in every page there'll be, you know, 17 Perry Rodan books and then three non-Perry Rodan books which have been released recently as ebooks anyway. So it's the same kind of thing in Audible. It used to be, now they've actually got a better filtering system, which I didn't realize. You used to click on new releases and it'd all be vampire books and fantasy, zombies, lots of zombie books and all that kind of stuff, all the latest fads, all the paranormal romance stuff. And then in among all of that, you'll find like the three science fiction and kind of modern fantasy books that you actually want to look up and that you're interested in. So actually Audible has got better now that they've sorted that out, and you can, they're sort of like classic science fiction and modern science fiction and classic fantasy. Oh no, was it? No, epic fantasy and modern fantasy. They've just sorted that out now. And also with the Perry Rodan, it's got its own section now. So you can search for anything not Perry Rodan. It's like...
Yes. And also like in the German Audible and iBook section, you find so many, even if it's not Perry Rodan, you find like lots of... other series of science fiction novels. Like you have book number 1, 2, and 4, and then you have to scroll through all of the different series, and then once, like in between, you can find a single standalone science fiction novel which you might want to read or not.
I want to make it so you can have an option. It's like, if I've not read the first book in this series, don't show me book number 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I don't need to see any of them. I'm already not going to buy... Anyway, so let's move on because we've been chatting like 15 minutes already. I actually want to talk about Hyperion. Should we get to it?
Yes.
So, the reason we both listen to this is because I mentioned that it was a favorite of mine from a few years ago, and it's sort of like a series of shorter stories put together into a novel. So, like, if you don't like one part of it, don't worry, just wait a bit, and you'll like a bit more. And I mentioned it to Juliana, and she found it, and it was a bit weird because it was combined together with Hyperion.
Endymion.
And it was called Hyperion Endymion, and it came in like 16 parts. And it turns out the first two parts were the actually what you wanted, wasn't it? It was
Yeah, it's called Hyperion and Endymion 1, part 1, and then part 2. And then I think it goes to 3. And these three novel, like these three audiobooks together is just Hyperion.
No, I think it was the two, and then the third one was the start of Fall of Hyperion. I think it
No.
was. Oh, wasn't it? Oh, it was three of them.
It's
Okay. Oh, no, yeah.
three parts and it's
Yes.
just one book, but
Yeah.
it's so confusing because it says Hyperion and Endymion 1, and then you find Hyperion and Endymion 2 and
Part
part
one
1, and
and two
it's
and three, yeah.
so confusing. I
Yeah.
don't know what they thought by doing it
But I
this
told you where to
way.
stop at the right point. I said stop at the end of
I did,
Hyperion. I said
yes.
when they all walk and down to see the Shrike,
When they
stop.
arrive,
Yeah, when they
and I
arrive on the
stopped
planet,
there,
yeah, and you stop there.
yes.
So that's good. And then of course you listen to that as an audiobook, and because I was like going, oh yeah, I remembered this story, and you're like, oh no, there was this story, and I'm like, I can't remember all the plot point, and I couldn't remember what to say, and as you're talking about it, I couldn't remember what was revealed where or what was revealed in Fall of Hyperion afterwards. So I decided I'm just going to listen to this as an audiobook myself. So I did, and. So while I was in New York, this is the reason why I've not updated the podcast for a long time. I've actually got like four this plus another three novels that I need to review. Plus, I've been working on other projects like finishing off the Minding Tomorrow series, and I finished off the editing of an entire feature length movie that another project which I'll talk about in the future, I'm sure. And So when I and I've been traveling a lot, so I was in New York for a week, and as I was cycling around New York and walking around New York, I decided to keep up with this novel, and I got through it and enjoyed it. And I thought, well, it would be fun if we both talk about it to make it a bit different, so it's not just me talking about a novel again. Although saying that, I did listen to the audiobook of Dune earlier this year, and I was planning on doing another review of that and didn't get round to it. I say that I review every single audiobook and science fiction book and ebook and fantasy book and all these other things that I read. It turns out I don't. I read quite a bit more and don't review. But so let's start off. So Hyperion is set in a world, and what I really enjoy about this, I mean, I could talk about the setup, but what I like about it is that Dan Simmons has got lots of really great ideas, and he never says no to any idea. If it's a good idea, he sticks it in there. In the same way that I did with my like Broken Glass, it's sort of like, oh, I've got this cool idea, let's put it in. Oh, I've got this cool idea, and I wanted to put in everything. And it seems like he did there. So just looking at some notes, you've got the like the technology, you've got the Farcasters, which are these portals that go between the worlds. You've got the Hawking drives, which you can fly between the worlds. You've got the I wrote down here the tree spaceship. Can't remember the name of that. Yeah, and you've got the world web and the techno core and all of these different kind of technological ideas going in there. And you'd think that, oh, well, if you've got spaceships, what do you need Farcasters for? Like, oh, if you've got Farcasters, what do you need the spaceships for? But he kind of somehow works out that, oh, yeah, you do need them, and if you've got this and you've got the. So you get the time dilation and you get the instant portals from one world to another, which is fun.
But on the other hand, you have the flying carpets,
Yes.
which to me is like it sounds like a fairy tale in it from 1001 Night or
Yeah, it's an Aladdin kind of story, isn't it?
yes,
Yeah,
yes.
but again, he kind of plays that in. It's like, oh yeah, flying carpets exist, except they turned out they were stupidly dangerous. It's like
Yes.
everyone going around in like on quad bikes or on scooters or something like that.
Yeah.
It felt like that kind of stupid technology. It's like, okay, you can wear a helmet, but you're still gonna probably drive off the road and wrap yourself around a lamppost. And so they're banned on all but a few worlds. So it's funny that you can introduce the technology and say, yes, the technology exists, and also it's not that common. And this
Yes.
exists, and but it's only used over here. Oh, and this exists, and then but actually it's not useful, so it only happens over here. And I quite like that layering of different, not so much levels of technology, but the different histories of technologies. And then the actual political setup of the world. You've got the I like it how the Earth has died. And we know that the Earth is no longer there, and you're like, well, why isn't it that? What's happening? Of course, we get filled in on why where the Earth has gone and what was going
Yes.
on there. So there you get the main thing is the hegemony of no, of humans, and the other political faction is the Ousters, which drift among the stars. But then within those, you get the different political groups. So you get the Technocore, which is the artificial intelligences, and then the human, is it the Senate? And you got the President, and the all this other stuff going on there. I can't remember all of the details. And even within these factions, you've got factions of factions, and yes, they all seem to exist in the same, in the same world at the same time. So there's a lot of complexity in here. And as you go through the novel, that kind of, well, it doesn't unravel, but you sort of, you know, you get introduced to the different layers, more and more of them. So I do think one of the most fun parts of this novel is actually kind of exploring this world, because each of the different stories that are told within this has a different point of view, and you see them from a different layer of society and a different character and a different position within the overall world.
Yeah, what I like is also that he creates a story around the little stories, and each story itself is like a little puzzle, which then when you get found out something about this, the about the world in the story, you can put that together and then finally get a bigger picture of the world itself.
Yeah. However, I was going to mention this, one of my main criticisms of Hyperion ties into that same thing. I was going to mention this at the end of the review, but I might as well bring it up now, is that once you get to the end, you realise that all of these things, I mean, let me put it this way, what I really enjoyed about it was the depth, and it felt like this was a very complex world, and all of, like, the real world. Like, when you go, oh, what about this thing over there, and what about this thing over here? And they don't seem connected, they just, it seems very human, it seems very lived in a way. In the same way that if you say, oh, what about this politics over here, and what about this trade over here, and what about this bit of history over there, in the real world, in our world, not everything is connected. It's just that there's lots of different factors. Like in North America, there'll be some factors, and in Europe, there'll be other factors. In this other country, there'll be other factors. And they, it seems like, oh, they're all disconnected, but they all just play in and make the world a lot richer. And that's what I thought we were getting here. Until you get to like the very end, and you realise that actually it's so interwoven, which is good, and it's clever in a way that he kind of weaves them all together and builds up this wider picture, and then it's interconnected. But in the end, it kind of, I think it diminishes the world, how interconnected it is in the end. It's like, oh yeah, and this, and the Ousters are actually over here, and this is what they did here, and this explains this part, and this explains this part, and then this person did this, and then this person did this, and by the end of that, you know, that sixth short story that you get at the end, you're just like, oh. Oh, it was all like, it was all planned out, and it all turns out it was just like two guys sort of worked out in the basement, and that's what the entire history of the entire galaxy seems to be. You know, it felt a bit too clean cut at the end. It took away that,
yes,
for me, it took away that, like, that messiness, which I actually really quite like about it. What do you think? Did you notice the same thing?
Not really.
You didn't?
No.
Oh. Well, for me, when it gets to the end of the console's tale, and it's just like, oh yeah, and I went here and I told this thing and I did that, and it's like, oh, you kind of like set it all out, and it's a bit too dry, and everything ties in together. You haven't read Dune yet, but if you read the first Dune novel, which you should probably stop after the first one, to be honest, but if you read that, the history seems like really complex, and it goes back thousands of years, and there's all the Titans. In the same way here, you've got the Titans and the and, you know, these things and these robots all fighting each other. Dune has got that same kind of sense of scale, and then you read the prequel trilogies and the prequel novels, and everything is all connected. The same with Star Wars as well. It's sort of like got this backstory which is mysterious, and then, you know, when you read the prequels, it's like, actually, it's all down to this one guy, and it's, oh, it all ties into him, and then this thing, and everything's too connected. You're like, oh, I liked it better when it was like far-reaching, and it's culminated in this story, rather than it had a starting point, widened out, and then came back to a single point again. You know, like in Star Wars, you got the family when it starts off and it's like one guy, and then it spreads out, and then it all comes back to one guy at the end. And I like it. I much prefer the idea of like all of it is culminating in this pilgrimage to the Shrike. And by the time you get to the end of it, it's just like, oh, well, this is just happening. You know, there's all of those other stuff which is actually more important than the pilgrimage to the Shrike. It's just, you know, it's like a minor part along the way which lets us explore this wider world, but you, and that actually comes out a bit more in Fall of Hyperion. And I think that if they'd have just stopped this story, just, you know, if they'd have just done the console's tale at the end and then just stopped it without having all of the different parts filled in, you know, all of the different things connected by the end of the console's tale. It's like, oh yes, and I went here and I did this and I did that and I did this, and actually all the whole story that you told before, it doesn't really matter because I did this, and the story that you told before, it doesn't really matter because I did this. Oh, and you over there, doesn't matter what you want because I've did this before. And, you know, it kind of negates all of the efforts that the other characters seem to put in. I don't know.
Yes.
Like, the console knew all of the answers all the way through. He just didn't tell anyone.
Yes, of course. But I think he's the kind of link in between. Like, he links all the other stories.
Oh, yes. He's together, our viewpoint so, character yes, all the way through.
I think that's just what he was aiming for, to get all these little stories at the end together for even people who didn't find out every single thing that was connected to the console. So, yeah, it's a bit of a summary.
Yeah, like, it's a bit too much of a summary. Yeah. It's like the whole thing that we the story before that was with, was it Bronn Lomia? She goes, oh, and there was this and this and this. And she's like, oh, yeah, and I gave my life and this poet died and we went through all of this and we chased through all this stuff just to find out this secret. And then it feels like a big secret. It feels like a big thing that they're finding out, that there's this whole other, these massive political... you know, maneuverings and all these wars going on, and she's got the key to it. And then the console just goes, "Yeah, I knew that already.
Yeah,
I just knew that already." Yeah, and it kind of diminishes the previous effort of the other people a little bit for me.
But that's so often how it works. That you think you worked it out yourself, you found it out, and for you it's a big thing. And then you tell it somebody, and they said, "Oh yeah, I worked that out long ago, and I did it myself like that." And
yeah, yeah.
Oh. But I did just something really great and cool and
yeah.
Oh, it's not worth anything.
Yeah, it's like, but that's the thing. Sometimes it's like at the end. Have you seen the movie Unusual Suspects? And the Usual Suspects, not Unusual. The Usual Suspects, and they tell this story, and at the end, it like they just go, and you work out the twist yourself, and then it's like, and now for the people who weren't paying attention, let me go through and explain this, and they have this montage of this guy looking around this office and going, oh, and that means this, and that means this, and then you're just like, yeah, thanks for all of that, but. Yeah, you're kind of, like, if you're left a little bit more to work it out yourself, and I think at the end this shows its hand a bit too much, shows how planned it all was, and I wish it had been a little bit more open at the end. Anyway, I think that's probably my only, one of my only complaints about this book. So let's go through these stories, like, we've already mentioned a few of them, so I have Wikipedia page open, which lets us do this, but let's go through The Priest. This is the first... Oh, yeah, just to make it clear, if you've not read this book and you're listening to this because you just want to hear the podcast and you don't care too much about spoilers, we haven't spoiled anything that much, have we, really?
No.
I haven't said what all the secrets are, even though I said they're given away at the end. So the idea is that these the Shrike is a thing, and there's a church which worship this thing, the Shrike.
It's this metal jewel thing.
It's a thing with four really arms and lots of spikes.
Yes.
Who captures people and sticks them on spikes. Like the Shrike bird, and he's got a tree with spikes on it.
With red jewel eyes or something.
Yeah, and he's moving backwards in time. Or he's moving... Anyway, the time tombs are this weird place where time flows wrong. And there's these time tides and time tombs and time tunnels and things. And if you go there, time gets fucked up, which is, you know, it happens a few times in different ways in this novel, playing with time. It's one of the main themes of this. And anyway, the Shrike, a prime number of people to go on a pilgrimage together, the Shrike will kill all of them, except one of them, and the one that it doesn't kill, it grants their wish. Theoretically.
Yes.
Isn't that the way it works? So you got
it's not proven.
It's not proven. Yeah, it's a religion, so you're never quite sure, you know, how much of it is true or how much of it is faith, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So they get these seven people together who go off and go along on this pilgrimage, and it takes them a while. They go on a tree spaceship, and then they go down on a shuttle, and then they go on a boat, and then they go on a barge, and then they go on a sailing ship.
They're also walking, aren't they?
Yeah, and at the end they walk as well, and they take a cable car, and every stage of this journey, another one of them tells their story, because they all agree at the beginning, hey, let's all tell our stories. And some of them want to do it, some of them don't, but in the end we get six of the seven stories. And the rest of it is kind of told from the console's point of view, and he goes last. And it's a good job he goes last, because if he went first, well, we'd have learnt all the secrets straight away and we wouldn't have needed the other stories. But all of the stories individually are very interesting, I think. And I think if it was just a collection, if you didn't have the frame story, and it was just a series of six stories all set in the same world, I think it would still work pretty well, even though the Shrike and the journey towards the Shrike is the thing that brings it all together. So let's do this. First of all, is the priest.
Oh, they at the beginning, they do a lottery. Who starts with his story?
Yeah.
And
the priest gets number one.
Yes,
yeah.
And it's really interesting how they do that, and then they start talking and discussing.
Yeah, it's like, I want to tell my story. No, I want to. I don't want to tell my story. Yeah, and it's quite a big discussion at the beginning.
It is.
If they should tell stories.
And then also, like, what you just mentioned, the different trips and the different transport they used. So
yeah.
There was one transport in the tree and one tells a story there.
Yeah.
And then it was this in the cable car and someone is telling his story in the cable car. And so
yeah.
You have, like, the transport and a story. And
yeah.
After every transport change, it's a new story.
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah, well, they tell some over dinner, they tell some, you know, as they're sitting around. And yeah, it's quite an interesting. And the other characters come and go, but mostly it's just these six people traveling along. So let's do it. The first story is the horror, the horrific story of the priest. And it's strange that this is a frame story within a frame story that actually the priest goes, oh, and I've got a book here and I'm going to read you out this book of this other person's story, and then I'll tell you my story. And so the main part of the priest story is actually another, a different priest. And that I really like, because it's told in a journal point of view, and you're not quite sure, and you realise, oh, I know what's going to happen at the end. And you're like, no, oh, it's a journal. He might, what's going to happen at the end? And yeah, yeah. And of course, the other priest fills in the rest of the story of the first priest, Hoyt. Is it Hoyt his name is?
Yeah, I think.
Let me go to the Wikipedia page here. So, it's the story of Paul Duret and Father Lena Hoyt. Two of the several thousand remaining priests of the Roman Catholic Church, and this tells them that they go. Duret gets to Hyperion and finds these tunnels, and we're never really sure what these tunnels are. But that's what he's there to. This big cleft in the rock with some tunnels at the bottom of it, or whatever it is. But there's this. He's going to investigate some artifacts or some interesting chasm. On Hyperion, and he gets there, and they find this band of these little people. And what did you first think about these little people were that he meets? There's this group of the 70,
yeah.
70 people, and it's like, oh, who are these people? Because I had all these different ideas, and the priest has lots of different ideas of who they could be or where they come from, and so what did you think of those guys?
Yeah, they were a bit like. It was a bit weird. They seemed to be a bit disabled, or
yeah.
However you would call it. They
yeah.
They couldn't. They didn't talk, and they were a bit like
childlike,
like
as well.
Childlike,
yeah,
and
yeah.
Behind in their with what they did, and they haven't had any tools to make stuff, and
yeah.
So it was it felt a bit. Weird.
Yeah, but it takes up a long time of the story of him just investigating and trying to work out. Now, the
yeah.
first time I read this, I had no idea what was going on
no.
here at all. And the interesting thing is because I didn't realise how weird the world was yet. Like I said at the beginning, it's like if he's got an idea, he puts it in. If he's got this, you know, if he's got this something that's interesting, he puts it in there. And I think this is one of the strongest stories from a science fiction point of view, because it's suddenly when you get to the end and you actually reveal what these people are, which I might as well not spoil. If you've read the book, you've read the book. If you've not, I'll leave it up to you to discover. But when you finally work that out, you're just like, oh shit. And then you actually work out what's going to happen to him and what the whole cruciform is. And it really sets off the book that the Shrike is this weird, sick...
monster.
Yeah, this
thing.
Monster thing, which even though you think, oh, this would be great, you know, this whole, you know, being immortal, how cool would that be? And then you realise, oh no, wait. Yeah, entropy, immortality in a universe where entropy still exists. Yeah, entropy plus immortality equals horror. And it's one of those things that you just go, wow, that kind of blows my brain in a way when he discovers what the little people are and then discovers that is his destiny in a way. You're just like... Oh, like that.
Poor
and then
guy.
And then immediately you realize, oh, this other father who's sweating all the time and is taking these painkillers, you're like, oh, right, you know. And then of course by the time he explains why he's going to meet the Shrike, you're like, yep, I got
yes.
that. But that the journey that those two priests take, and you know, the ending of that is, I just thought, was incredible.
But it's quite impressive how most of the story the priest tells is not his own story.
Yeah, like I say, it's a frame
it's
story
a,
within a
like
frame
a
story.
Little, a tiny bit at the end, and yeah, maybe at the beginning, is his own story, and the most of the bit in the middle is another guy's, like the other priest's
yeah.
story, where it's explained what's going on and what then will happen to him as well. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was quite...
But it needs to be that, because it couldn't just be one priest, because otherwise what's he doing in the pilgrimage? You know, that's not the end of his story. But then you have to set that up to realise, oh, all of these people are going on a pilgrimage to see the Shrike.
Yeah, for a reason.
And for a reason. Yes. And it's one of those ideas that you have, that the Shrike is going to be totally logical. He's going to grant your wish, but he's going to grant your wish in the way that he thinks is best, or it thinks is best, or in a way that... So you could say, I want to live forever. And it's like, yay. It's like, I wish for 3 more wishes, you know, that kind of thing. I wish that I'm going to be together with this my girlfriend forever. Oh, I wish... You know, and there's all these things, you know, and these wishes which... You know, the rules of wishes that you get in fairy tales. Yes. Like, you're not allowed to wish for 3 more wishes. You're not allowed to wish for someone to fall in love with you. I think that's Aladdin, you know, the story that we're saying before there.
But what makes the reader or the listener so involved in the story is that when you listen to all the single stories and you get the story of each of the characters, you kind of build your own view of them, and then you want this guy to get the wish come true.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to bring that up at the end. It's like, who did you want the who did you want the Shrike's whose wish did you want the Shrike to answer? But this story really sets up the whole, yes, this is like you said before, this is an Aladdin thing. You know, that's why they have the flying carpets. You've definitely got like a genie in the bottle here.
Yes.
The time tunes, something is going to do it. It's like, oh, I want to be young again. You know, it's that kind of wish. Oh, I want to be, you know, it's like, do you really want to be young again? Which we'll get onto in a later story. But I think this is a great way to set up actually what these people must be desperate if they actually are willing to volunteer to go and deal with a Shrike, knowing the kind of thing that the Shrike does to people or can do to people. And, you know, they know 6 of them are going to die and only one of them is going to get through. So let's move on to the second one, which is a soldier. Now, you've just read Use of Weapons, and did you see any similarities between Use of Weapons and the Soldier's Tale? Because this tells what is Colonel Assad, and he's in this simulation, and and when he's in this war simulation, when he's just a young guy, he meets this woman in the simulation, and they have hot sex together, and then he keeps meeting her in other simulations, and then finally he meets her in real life, and where he meets her in real life is actually in the Time Tunes when he crash lands on Hyperion, you know, in a previous battle. What did you think of this story? Or do you not remember this one so much?
I do remember this one quite, like, just a little, not as much as I do remember others. And I do remember when I listened to it, I was sitting in the office and I was chatting to you somehow on Facebook or something, and I wrote, oh, in the Hyperion soldier story, it's quite a lot of sex in it. And then he said, oh, I can't remember that.
Yeah.
I was sitting there in my office and getting like quite a bit red, because it was like, oh, okay, but it's good that you, after listening, you mentioned that as well.
Yeah, because I'd forgotten how much, like, it's just like, it's like really quite graphic. You know, there's a lot of times there's graphic violence and there's graphic horror in this. And this book is like, okay, I've done horror, now I'm going to do this weird sexual fantasy kind of thing, which, again, weird, especially when I was like walking around New York, cycling around New York, and I was like, oh yeah, Julianne has a point. She she mentioned the sex, and I'd totally forgotten about this. Yes, there's a lot of that. But the reason I bring up Use of Weapons is that there's the character in that, it's like, okay, I go and do this battle, and then I do this thing, and it's kind of like a telling of the military and the problems that you have, you know, being a soldier. It's like, I've been sent to do this job. How will I do this job? And in Use of Weapons, you've got the, well, you sent me to do the job, I did what you wanted. It's like, yeah, but I sent you to do the job, but you killed everyone. It's like, one way to ensure peace is that nobody is left living on either side, or everyone in the enemy is dead, you know. That's one way to ensure peace. And there's that same kind of thing that goes through there. And also, in Surface Detail, you actually get the same character again for Zakalwi from Use of Weapons. He comes back, and he has a similar story as well, where he's in the simulation. And I'm just wondering how much of... I think actually Use of Weapons was written before Hyperion. I'm not saying there's an influence on each other, but it seems a bit strange that they're both are soldiers in a simulated war. And it's a similar tale. I think this one is one of the more forgettable ones, because it really just sets up like the overall battle, you know, and the the battle that we already know is going to happen between the ousters and the hegemony, and I can't even remember what. Oh yes, of course, I do actually like the last line. It's like, oh, and when I meet this woman again, and I meet the Shrike again, and they go, what are you going to do? I'm going to kill them. And they've all got these things in the box, and some of them think, oh, what's he got in the box? Is it going to be a weapon? Is it going to be a way to kill it? You know, what's he going to do with this? Oh, it's going to be like this bound, another genie in a bottle kind of situation. I can't remember what the, what was the thing in the box? I can't remember what the thing in the box was. Anyway, another...
Wasn't it this, another, this living creature thing?
Yeah, but I can't remember it bound in four dimensions or eight dimensions. I can't remember the details of that. But again, it's another genie in a bottle, don't let it out kind of thing. So next one is the poet. You say you remember this one best, of the poet's story.
Yes, because at this point I realised why, like, you have these different... names. You have like Hyperion, and you have the city Keats, which is mentioned before, like when the soldier talks, and I think the priest as well. But anyway, when you listen to that as a German audiobook, and of course the names mm-hmm. of the cities are pronounced English, but you can't read it, so you don't know how it's spelled, and it could be K E E T S, whatever, and then. In the story of the poet, I found out that it's actually like Keats, like John Keats, like the poet. And then it made everything make more sense. And I looked him up on Wikipedia, and I found, oh, he wrote
Hyperion,
and he wrote Endymion, and oh yeah, and he had this wife, and everything made way more sense then.
And also, he's almost as famous for being the tortured artist that the poet in this is, and with his unfinished poem. You know, I've never really read Keats. I don't know Hyperion as a poem. I'm not big into poetry in that way. So there's probably thousands of references that I'm missing in this, and, you know, allusions here and there. But I do... Yeah, this is the... This is where it suddenly starts coming together, you know, in this way, and you realize, but what I really love about this is, again, the science fiction ideas of the house that spread over 18 worlds, and all of that kind of thing. And you get a bit more into the idea of creativity, and it's a book. This is a story about writing a story, about writing a story, about writing a story. You got all these layers going on there that he's writing, and he does this well, and he's So, yeah, I think this is one of the most memorable things. And again, when you come back to the references, there's a book like when I was talking to you before about the book of Book of the New Sun and the Book of the Long, was it the Book of the New Earth? No, what was it? Anyway, there's a book. I remember I was sitting in bed reading, and I was like, oh, he's going to do a Jesus bit now. You know, remember that? I was like, oh, and he's going to walk on water. Oh, yeah, and he does. Oh, and he's going to heal this person. And I realised, oh, he's doing a retelling of the New Testament and Jesus here and the setting up of a new religion. And you can kind of see it coming if you know the reference. And in there, it was a very obvious reference to me, and there's lots of obvious references in lots of books. Whereas I think in here, there's probably so many references that I don't get to go with the 10% of references that I do get.
Yes.
And I know that's true, because on this time that I read through it, well, I listened through it, when we got to the next story, or one of the stories where Bron Lamia is telling, like, talking about her, you know, the different things in the techno core, the different people, and I was like, oh, I realize now this is they're actually saying that there's these where I want to become gods, and then there's the humans, and I realize, oh, it's a replaying of the old Greek myths where you had the titans who were born from this god and then defeated them, and then you got the next lot of gods who were warring against the titans, and then their son Zeus came along and defeated the titans and then became king, and you realize that there's these levels of different, I wouldn't say mythological beings, because in this book they're not mythological, there's actually humans who gave birth to the technocore and the AIs, who are also then trying to give birth to the next level, and, you know, how much do they want the next level of intelligence to come along, and, you know, and there's that whole levels there, which I guess is what Hyperion the poem does, because it's like this epic poem of retelling. Yes. Again, I don't know that, but now, like, reading it this time and seeing that there's so many more levels to it, that I could get or couldn't get. However, I do think some of it in this, I think this is a little bit tied into, it's a bit too much focused on, oh, and there was this poet from the 19th century and this poet from the 20th century and this author from the 19th century and this author from the 20th century. And it seems like even though this is set 700-800 years in the future, they seem a little bit too obsessed with the 19th and 20th century poetry, that the entire universe seems to be revolving around some poetry from the 19th century. It's like, how important is today's day and age, especially if Keats is a poet that I don't even know.
Yes.
Even now in the 21st century, I kind of don't know who it is and haven't really got all the references. Well, it seems like in the 29th century, suddenly people do know who Keats is and everyone does know that. And I thought that was a, yeah.
Yes, I don't know why he picked this poet for his main focus.
Yeah.
But I try to, like, when there was a movie coming out, Bright Star it was called, and I went into with some friends and watched that, and in fact the story itself wasn't that good, but the pictures they made, like, yeah, and
the cinematography
was great. And then after that I tried to read some of his poetry, and it's quite difficult.
Keats, yes,
and his poetry is quite metaphoric, and lots of things he says, he takes cool, like, good words and, like,
yeah,
descriptions, and it's very, very, however you would,
yeah,
describe it, it's not really easy to read his poetry. It's not like,
yeah,
some straight words telling,
yeah,
a poem and,
yeah,
some love story.
Well, actually, in the Poet's Tale, he actually says that. It's like, when I did my epic, I took a bit of this character's guy and I took a bit of this poet and a bit of this poet and the wit of this poet and the description of this poet and the imagery of this poet, and he sort of combines them all together into the greatest poem ever, which,
yes,
isn't finished at the end.
Yeah, but
and I wish Dan Simmons hadn't finished this. I wish Hyperion had been his unfinished epic and just stopped after this one before we got to Fall of Hyperion, which I don't want to get into.
I haven't read.
No, don't bother. It's really bad.
But I think what's important to mention is that the poet gets his inspiration of the Shrike.
Yeah, the Shrike is his muse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which I find pretty, like, it has two levels of that.
Yeah.
Like, one point he's inspired by a monster.
Yeah.
Like, by something that kills people and torture people.
And when he runs out of people to kill, he can't write his poetry.
Yeah, so it's a bit weird that this poet only can write his poetry when people are killed and tortured,
yeah,
and... Which is a bit, I think.
But it comes down to the thing, it's like, well, why is it? It's like, oh, Hyperion was named after the moon of Saturn when the people moved here from there. Oh, and I just happened to name the city Keats. Oh, and I just happened to know this poet, and I just happened to think the most important poet is Keats, and I just happened to do this. Oh, and I just happened to do it. And you're just like, yeah. But I mean, the thing is, when you get past all these references that I don't even understand, I still find a fun story, a fun imagery. There's, like, something going on here at the heart of it, which isn't just, oh, I know lots and lots of references to 19th century poets, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas I found a little bit, like, with the Book of the New Sun, I mentioned it, in my review, maybe I didn't put it in these words, but it felt like when you get to the end of the story, you realise, oh, this is, it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle without knowing that, first of all, it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle without realizing you're doing a jigsaw puzzle. And then when you get to the end and you put all the jigsaw puzzle pieces together, what you're looking at is a picture of somebody doing a jigsaw puzzle, you know, and it's like this regressive thing. It's all it is just, you know, layers and layers of people putting together jigsaw puzzle pieces or references from, you know, other works of literature. And at the core of it, it's just that. But whereas here, I think it's different. What you get here in the Poet's Tale is that you get a story, and actually the whole work is like a story of puzzle pieces. But when you put them all together, you realise that each of these puzzle pieces are references to other works of literature, you know, from epics of the ancient world up through Shakespeare and up through, and I was going to say up to the poets, but it's even more than that. Like, you get the noirish stories, and you get these other kind of stories that based on 20th century pulp literature as well, and on science fiction. You get all of them together, but when you put them all together, it's not just a jigsaw puzzle of a jigsaw puzzle, you know, of someone doing a jigsaw puzzle. It's actually, there's a story behind it as well, and I found that interesting. So that means it doesn't matter if you don't get all the references, there's still something at the end which you can still enjoy, even if you don't get all the references, which I think is important. Yeah, let's move on to the next story because we're only halfway through, and I want to finish this up. Not, I don't want this to go too long. So the scholar, talk to me about the scholar who's got his daughter Rachel.
Oh yes, the daughter Rachel, which is yeah, like in the beginning of the book, you have this scholar and a baby.
Yeah.
And you don't realize why does he take his baby to the shrike? What does he want there? It's a dangerous monster. And then he tells a story, and I found that so moving. It was like for me the most emotional story in the whole. Like
yes,
and
I think that's what it's meant to be. Because like you say, we've got these different stories. We've got the horrific story. We've got the war story. We've got the story about the story and the fun sci-fi things. And we discover the world. And then this book is really meant to give us like a person to care about or a story to really really care about.
Yes, and so yes.
The daughter is aging backwards and losing her memory as she goes backwards. It's again, that's all there is to say about it in some ways, but there's so much more.
It reminded me so much of Benjamin Button.
Yeah.
So that I wasn't quite sure which one was the original and which one was the stolen.
I think Benjamin Button is way older. But also, it's they could even call it the Merlin disease because it's, you know, the once and future king or something with the Merlin story there. I think that's what it says here on Wikipedia as well. But that's where I knew the story from. But you didn't really understand what was going on when you first meet the baby. However, the consul says, oh, there's that general, he's really famous. Oh, and there's the wandering Jew with the baby. But you don't know it's his daughter. Or he says it's his daughter. I can't remember if they say at the beginning if it's his daughter or not, but it's him with the baby. And he's obviously famous. So this is a known story. So it's him kind of filling in on the details. So to the people who are with him on the pilgrimage, they all know who this guy is. And they kind of know the story, but only from like the documentary press point of view, the tabloid media point of view, rather than his own point of view. So that's really interesting.
And this also is a big reference to all like things that happen in our time when you have something bad happen to your family, and it's quite like a big thing. The press just comes to your house, and you are just like they hunt you down, and like they when he keeps on telling the story of his daughter, even they chase his daughter
even
because she doesn't know anything, because every single day is a new
oh, but it's so poignant when she says, daddy, tomorrow don't tell me the full story, just let me live my life, just lie to me. And you're like, no, you can't do that. And then he does, and you're like, oh, that's so much better. Like, he doesn't put her through that pain every time. And it really brings it back to, like, when you hear about people with Alzheimer's disease and they can't remember, or Parkinson's, no, not Parkinson's, no, it's Alzheimer's, isn't it, where you do that, and someone says, oh, is Tommy here? And you just go, no, Tommy died. And you realise that each time you just say that, and for them, it's for you, it's like, oh, yeah, Tommy died years ago, but for them, it's they're being told that that person's died for the first time. Yes. And of course, that's not really mentioned so much in this book, but it must be that same kind of thing when you're losing your memories and then you're being filled in on them, like what's just taken for granted by everybody else. And yeah, it is such a real pity. And he tries everything, and the only thing that's left is, oh, I've got to go and take her back to the shrike.
Yes.
The shrike caused this, or, you know, the time tombs, that whole thing caused it. I've got
but
to sort
actually,
it out.
He decided that quite late, actually.
Almost too late. We don't know how late it is.
It's such a pain when, like, his daughter's birthday, and then she's quite excited about that. And
she's
then,
getting a new bike.
And all these little stories, and it's so moving and emotional. And like when her lover takes her back to her parents, and then she forgets about him.
Yeah.
And he comes to visit them.
Oh,
and,
that's so...
and all that. And like at the beginning, when she's still older, she has her own diary, kind of, where she talks to herself.
Yeah, she records it every evening to tell herself in the morning.
And tell herself. But then every single, like, or when her father tells the story every time, for him it's just a constant pain.
Yeah.
And for her it's always a new pain.
She thought that's a bit like Minding Tomorrow. Yeah. I know, I shouldn't tell. Oh, spoiler for my novel. And the other thing with the moving backwards in time, which really brings me back to my first point, it's like, it's a good idea, let's put it in there. It's not explained. You know, he, like, the shrike did this. How did he do it? Well, don't know. Something's
it's
happening.
Time tomb.
And the end, yeah, it's something happening in the time tomb. It's something happening in the time tunnel. The shrike did a thing, and the thing is the thing. And then you're like, oh, okay. so let's just go with this, yeah? Okay. And that's it. And the whole galaxy, the whole universe is trying to work out how the Shrike did this. And of course, by the end of the book, you realize not how the Shrike did it, but how the Shrike is capable of doing something like that with its, you know, because it's, well, it's from the future, you know, and it takes things backwards in, you know, with this weird thing. But it's not explained why, even though, and I quite like that, it leaves in that, like, magical, kind of horrific, the Shrike can do anything, even if it's going to grant your wish, it can do anything kind of thing, element. So let's, next on the thing is the detective. This really explains a bit more politics. This is a bit more, less backstory now, like, hey, what's going on right now? And we actually get Keats turning up in the form of a artificial intelligence controlling a clone of himself. I'm not sure if it's a clone of his original DNA. I'm not sure where they'd have got that from, but we do get a bit more of, you know, sort of Keats comes along and Braun Lamia. Now, if you actually look at the Wikipedia page, it turns out Braun is the name of Fanny Braun was the name of John's lover, John Keats's lover in real life.
Yes.
And in the next book, in The Fall of Hyperion, we find out other connections there as well, and between the other characters. It turns out that the daughter Rachel is the one who is traveling backwards through times with the general, you know, the sex scenes with the general or something. I think they match up. I don't have it all fully cleared up in my head, but some of these characters you suddenly realize, oh yeah, these characters are even more connected than you thought they were. Because I think it's amazing when the general says, oh yeah, and I saw some of you stuck on the tree of the Shrike, the spikes on the Shrike. Who is it? I'm not going to tell you. And you're like, let's, and you realize, oh, okay. So when they get there, they're going to get to the time tunes, and then they're going to start traveling backwards through their own time, or forwards, backwards through. It's weird. And when you start looking at that, you go, oh, these characters that she's meant to have been traveling backwards through time, and Rachel is also aging backwards in time, and some of these characters are also going to be going back through time. So I actually quite enjoyed that story because it's a bit more action, and like you say, there's a bit more flying carpets going on there too. Anything else you want to say about that story? Because while I enjoyed that one,
it's not like outstanding, no. But I quite enjoyed also like the idea of the affair that Braun Lamia has with the Johnny with, yeah. the robot yeah. With the artificial
Johnny Five alive.
Yeah. Yes. I quite like this idea, and it's a little bit like in Isaac Asimov, on Solaria, where this woman and she like in the Robots of Dawn,
yeah.
where she has a husband,
yeah.
and it turns out that her husband, like she explained him her husband, and it turns out that he's a robot in fact. So it's a bit like this.
Spoiler!
A bit like the relationship between human and robot and how far that can go.
I didn't really see it in that kind of explanation, you know, because I thought that he's obviously so human in some ways, but then so I didn't really see it as an exploration of hot robot human action.
No, it's not a hot human interaction, but. It's a part of that story.
Yeah. Okay.
Which I quite...
The thing is, for me, this is one of the one times, maybe it's because I knew what was going to happen in the next story or something, but when I got to this part, there was this action scene and then more action scene and then more action scene. I was like, yeah, but I know, just get through, you know, and it got to the point where, like, I was listening to it as an audiobook and I kind of faded out a few times at this point. It kind of faded out in the background because it's like, oh, yeah, and they're going to do some more shooting and they do this, but I really like, actually, the battle sequence at the end. But, again, it gets to the point, well, he's not that good at writing action because there's this whole gunfight going up to the Shrike temple and it just lasts ages, and then this bullet comes here and does that, and the bullet comes here and does that, and you're thinking, well, if these people really are shooting at them with machine guns, they either a machine gun kills you or it doesn't kill you. And it's one of those movie conventions that if a bad guy gets hit by a gun, they die instantly by falling off a building or exploding, like with a bullet to the head. And if a good guy gets shot even by 1,000 bullets, they still have enough time to gasp out those last words and just take this, it's going to be important, this emblem, this thingy, take this. And you're just like, really? And it felt a little bit like that. But then again, that whole story is like a, hey, we're going to do detective action sequence thing. We're going to have a gunfight because that's always what happens at the end of a detective story. And that's the way to...
Yeah, that's the detective part of the retelling. Novel. Yeah.
Okay, so we've been going an hour. Let's see if we can get to this last story and then just wrap up some different... So at the end, you get the console, and this is another frame story, the frame story, where he pretty much goes, I'm going to tell my story. And he gets out this recording device and go, play. And it's like, oh, you're cheating. You just got like an audio book and you just play. And I'm not, I wasn't quite sure. This was written, Wikipedia tells me this was written as a standalone story, short story. And I think you can kind of tell because it's got this weird, like out of sequence, like non-linear aspect to it, which none of the other stories have in that same way. I mean, the whole story is non-linear because like the Poet's Tale, but most of that takes place really in the far past, and others take place throughout time. So, but this is within it, within a frame story, and I didn't think, while I really enjoy the story, I didn't think, I was wondering why this recording was mixed up in this way. It seemed a bit too neat to have happened by accident, but then why would you tell the story in that way? Why didn't you just say, well, I went down to this planet and this was it? And it's really nice how it feeds out different individual parcels of information that so you understand that there's the time, another time thing where he gets the time dilation, so he flies out to the world and comes back, and then flies out to the world and comes back, and he's aging a year or 6 months in between each meeting, and his girlfriend, later wife, and, you know, mother of his children, she's aging 7 years, or no, it's 11 years, isn't it? 11 years in between each one, or 7 years, yeah. I can't remember. And I think it's a really well-told story if it was just a short story, like it was originally. But then it becomes like artificial in that way, like the storytelling at this point. Well, the others are like, hey, I'm going to tell a story. And it's like, okay, you're going to tell it in a noir style. You're going to tell it in a horror style. You're going to tell it in a, you know, in an intimate kind of human... interest story kind of style. This suddenly becomes, I'm going to tell it in a science fiction short story style. And you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
It's a little bit too cute in that way, I think.
Yeah. In fact, I can't remember this part so
really?
Well. Yes, because I think it's just not... I wouldn't say it's too weak, but it's not outstanding enough.
Well, I think if it was just a short story, it would be effective.
Yes. But like in part of these other stories, yeah. Like you have this emotional and then the horror and all this. Yeah. But this is just like, it doesn't fit. So it's not outstanding so much that I can remember so much.
So for me, it's one of my favorite short stories, but it's not my favorite. If these were just like six short stories, that would be my favorite. But as in the novel itself and where it's told, and especially, but what I do like about it is actually how much it kind of sets you. You've thought you knew who the good guys were throughout this book, and then by the end of that story you realize, oh, the hegemony is actually, you know, this weird dictatorship style, you know, like we're gonna do this and doesn't care about dolphins and, you know, wipes out, you know, all these different things which you didn't realize. You thought, oh, like where the poet was going around all those worlds, you think, oh, this is pretty cool, you know. And then when the when the detective and doing her stuff and going around, you're like, oh, that's cool, yeah, sure, it looks a bit like dystopian in some ways, but then you realize just how dystopian this world is, and that's when you go, oh, so who do we want to win again? And then the console goes in and goes, well, actually, I'm going to tell you who you want to win. And it kind of leaves it up to you to decide, oh, are the ousters the good guys? The other ones the good guys? This is good. But I did, like I say, that's where it becomes a little bit too clean, a little bit too like, oh, and I'm going to wrap it up now, and this has all come together, and it's all going to do this, and now we're going to see the Shrike. And you're like, well, does it matter that you see the Shrike now? I'm not sure. And I can't remember what he wanted to see the Shrike for. All the others, I can remember why they want to see. I think I can remember why they want to see the Shrike, but I'm not so sure. So, what's your favourite of these stories?
I actually think it's the Jew with his
the scholar,
the scholar with his daughter.
Yeah.
Because it tells not only his story.
Yeah.
It tells the story of his family and all the how are we going to get around with this. Weird, nobody knows what's going on thing. And Yeah, so I
so
like
you want
this one.
You want his you want the Shrike to honor his story, his request at the end. For me, I really like the first story that, for the horror of it, and in like that dawning realization, it really does set the scene really well. Like I say, I like the console's backstory, his grandfather's story, which is what we actually hear. I really like that as a short story. The poet, I think, is my favorite, just because like every time I think of this book, even though you told it from the console's point of view, he's too kind of hidden. But the poet is like this foul-mouthed guy who just goes, like this.
But I must admit, the German, like, in the audiobook, all the stories are told by different voices. Right now, I can't remember if it was, like, one narrator telling the stories just with different...
Accents?
Yeah. In the German version, I don't know. But the voice of the poet, I liked... the least.
Oh, really?
It was a terrible voice, and it was like this, like
they tried to make it a gruff old man. Yeah,
and I like this voice at the least, and so it's probably part of influencing.
Yeah. And this is the thing that you got to work out with the like audiobook narration. There's some books where the narration can really bring out new things and interesting things and make you look at a book and you can appreciate it. But there's sometimes the narration is so bad that you realize if I didn't actually have to listen to this, like that, you know, I did a review of Red Shirts and of course the 100,000 Kingdoms, both of these books I could probably have enjoyed a lot more if I didn't have to listen to a terrible audiobook narration. So in my head, I kind of try and separate that out. But I do know what you mean with this. Like I've read this book as a normal book before, as a paper book. Was it the Dead Tree version? And then I listened to this, and some things really came out more. For example, the Shakespearean language in the console's tale, where he's talking about Ciri, and Ciri talks in verse. I mean, yeah, but when you're reading it, you didn't really notice that so much until you actually get the lines of all the people from this island planet. You know, this planet with all these islands in, and they're all talking, and you're like, oh. Oh, he really is just doing Shakespeare, even though in the first time I read it, I was like, oh, yeah, this is a bit like Romeo and Juliet. You know, there's this whole thing. They have the sword fight and he, you know, when he gets angry and they do this and they're star-crossed lovers, literally star-crossed lovers in this case, you know, they're and, you know, they're from different sides and all of that kind of stuff. But then, like, when I was reading it, I kind of picked out those references. But then when somebody was reading it to me, that's when it, like, the poetry of the language and they're speaking in verse. And I was like, oh, right. Ah, you know, it really
came
up.
At first, I didn't even realise that. Maybe I just didn't listen to that
closely
enough. Yeah. But I think it has also something to do with translate Shakespeare into German is something that it's difficult.
Like, no, this isn't real Shakespeare. I don't think there's any specific lines. It's not like, I bite my thumb at you, sir. You know, I'm not sure if it's like that kind of thing. But there are definitely, the flavour is definitely.
It's easier to understand when it's actually in English than it's a difference than to the German language used.
Yeah, the narration we've got, it says here, narrated by Mark Vita, Alison Johnson, Kevin Parisu, Jay Snyder, Victor Bavine. So yeah, the different characters have different things. Oh, this is just by one guy, is it?
Yeah,
the German version is just narrated by one person. And I think sometimes I'm not so sure about these multicast things, but here each character tells their full story just with their voice. So the multi-character voices...
makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense, actually. I think it works better in this book than it has in other books that I've listened to where they've got in different actors for the different parts. Of course, in the frame story itself, they each say their own lines, which works out well. It's a bit strange because when it's two men talking, they're slightly more difficult to distinguish the voice actors. So one of them says something and the other one replies, said the console. The other one replies, said the poet. And then the woman's voice comes in, blah, 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 says Born Labia. And you're like, well, of course it's her because she's the only woman there. It's like there. They didn't actually need to say who was talking with the other ones. It was good. The only problem is of any of the narrators, I think, was the female narrator, which I can actually just look up her name because it's here. It would be Alison Johnson. She can't do an English accent very well, which is quite important when you're doing a 19th century English poet. I guess he's English, or he might be Welsh or Scottish or something like that. Anyway, but she did an English accent not very well. Of course, I'm English, so I could pick up on that probably more than other people, but that was noticeable. But I think the rest of the narration, let me have a look at the notes. Did I make any other Oh yeah, and also the other she's meant to be Braun Lamia is she's like 5 foot tall but 5 foot wide. You know, she's this super powerful, strong woman, and the narrator actually has quite a light, lilting voice. She sounds more like a, you know, someone who's tall and slim and blonde rather than someone who's short and beefy and from a heavy planet. I think that's all of my notes and all this. Anything else you want to say about it? Anything? I think we've talked about most of the stuff that we wanted to talk about.
Yes.
So overall, I normally give star ratings for this book. I think before I gave this a 4-star rating or maybe 4.5 stars. Can I look it up here? I think I'll have the... if I double-click this, it should come up and I can have a look here. So Hyperion, I gave... Dan Simmons. I gave Hyperion 4 stars when I first read it. I think I'd just give it 4 stars again because I think it is a good book. I do have reservations and I think I talked about them here. What would you give it if you're going to rate it out of stars? If you're going to rate it on Amazon or Goodreads, what would you give it?
I don't know. Maybe I even rated it on Goodreads and now it would be weird if I rated it again without knowing my star rates on Goodreads.
You don't have to give it a star rating. There's lots of reviewers who don't like giving ratings. I give it's just easy for me.
I think I would give 2 separate star ratings, like what? One for the book itself.
Yeah, like the overall novel.
Like the book and one for the Audible audiobook, which okay. I just...
Well, that's what you do on Audible. Look, it says here, where's the Audible page? So people actually give it 3. You got the overall, the performance, and the story.
Yes.
So what would you give overall?
3.
For the performance?
Three as well.
But for the story?
For the story, 4.
4, yeah, okay. So if you'd have just read this rather than listened to it, you think you'd have enjoyed it more?
Yes, I think I would.
And how about if you'd have read it in the original English? Would you have enjoyed it more than in German? Is it a tricky one?
Not really. I think it was good that I heard it in German because some of the things are quite difficult to understand when you don't understand single words and you have to look up quite a lot. And then
this book might have been a bit complex in English. Yes. I don't know. So yeah, good book. Recommended by both of us. Now, if we seem to like read another book or listen to another audiobook, maybe you can come back in the future. You've had fun with this discussion?
I think I enjoyed it, yes.
Yeah, okay, that's good. Hopefully some people email in luke@juggler.net if you've enjoyed this discussion. Again, I'm not always going to do like totally spoilerific in-depth discussions like this, but when a good friend of mine who also happens to be staying in the same room with me on a cruise ship where we're together, Queen Victoria. That's I've almost forgot which ship we're on now. I thought we'd have time over these 3 days at sea to record this podcast, and it's been fun. So if you've enjoyed this and if you want to hear Juliana again, if we read another book, maybe we'll do Dune again because I read that earlier this year. So if you read it in German and I might read it again. No, I just read it earlier. Listen to it as an audiobook, so I probably don't need to listen to it again. But maybe we can do a discussion of Dune, like, because I've already done a review of that already. What do you think?
Okay, sounds good.
Because the other books that you've read, maybe we'll do a Player of Games one as well. I've not reviewed that, and I probably need to read that again. Maybe I'll do an audiobook of that. It's one of my favourite novels ever. Maybe we'll do this again in the future. So I think that's about it. You can check me out on Goodreads.com. You can follow me there or become my friend on there, and then I can see what you're reading as well, and I can look up your reviews. In fact, I've got the Goodreads page open for, I think, is this Hyperion? Oh, that's Little Fuzzy that I'm going to be reviewing next or soon. Yeah, and this Hyperion is one of the most reviewed and rated books by friends of mine. So I don't know how many friends I have on Goodreads.com, but 152 of my friends have either marks this as to that they want to read it, have rated it, or have reviewed it, and it's got a 4.21 average rating of friends of mine. So this is obviously a book which is held in high regard, even though a few people have only, like, Tony G rated it 2 stars, Tamahomi 4 stars, Ryan 5 stars, but you know, 4 stars is a good average. Oh, look, there's a picture of the Shrike. You see it?
Great.
And there's what the Shrike sticks the things to the yeah. Anyway, that'll do for now. Thanks a lot for listening. Thank you, Juliana, for joining in.
Thank you.
And I'll catch you next time.